Chapter 3 Deep In. Lanny hears his piss gurgle into the screw-top plastic liter bottle. It's awkward, kneeling here in the dark, and he doesn't like the way the bottle warms in his hand, filling. He caps it by feel and stands it upright in the corner that's farthest from his head when he sleeps. In the morning, he'll carry it under his coat to the men's and empty it. The old man knows he's too sick now to crawl out, to walk the corridor every time, but they have this agreement. Lanny pisses in the bottle and takes it out when he can. He doesn't know why the old man lets him stay here. He's offered to pay, but the old man just keeps building his models. It takes him a day to complete one, and they're always perfect. And where do they go when he finishes them? And where do the unbuilt kits come from? Lanny has a theory that the old man is a sensei of kit building, a national treasure, with connoisseurs shipping in kits from around the world, waiting anxiously for the master to complete their vintage Gundams with his unequaled yet weirdly casual precision, his zen moves perhaps leaving each one with a single, minute and somehow perfect flaw, at once his signature and a recognition of the nature of the universe. How nothing is perfect, really. Nothing ever finished. Everything is process, Lanny assures himself, zipping up, settling back into his squalid nest of sleeping bags. But the process is all a lot stranger than he ever bargained for, he reflects, bunching a fold of sleeping bag to pillow his head against the cardboard, through which he can feel the hard tile wall of the corridor. Still, he thinks he needs to be here. If there's any place in Tokyo Rez's people won't find him, this is it. He's not quite sure how he got here. Things got a little fuzzy around the time the syndrome kicked in. Some kind of state change, some global shift in the nature of his perception. Insufficient memory. Things hadn't stuck. Now he wonders if, in fact, he did make some deal with the old man. Maybe he's already covered this, the rent, whatever. Maybe that's why the old man gives him food and bottles of flat mineral water and tolerates the smell of piss. He thinks that might be it, but he isn't sure. It's dark in here, but he sees colors. Faint flares and swaths and stipplings moving. Like the after images of the data America flows are permanent now, retinally ingrained. No light penetrates from the corridor outside. He's blocked every pinhole with black tape, and the old man's halogen is off. He assumes the old man sleeps there, but he's never seen him do it, never heard any sounds that might indicate a transition from model building to sleep. Maybe the old man sleeps upright on his mat, Gundam in one hand, brush in the other. Sometimes he can hear music from the adjacent cartons, but it's faint, as though the neighbors use earphones. He has no idea how many people live here in this corridor. It looks as though there might be room for six, but he's seen more. And it may be that they shelter here in shifts. He's never learned much Japanese, not after 8 months. And even if he could understand, he guesses, these people are all crazy, and they'd only talk about the things crazy people talk about. And of course, anyone who could see him here now, with his fever and his sleeping bags, his iPhones and his cellular data port, and his bottle of cooling piss, would think he was crazy too. But he isn't. He knows he isn't, in spite of everything. He has the syndrome now. The thing that came after every test subject from that Gainesville orphanage. But he isn't crazy. Just obsessed. And the obsession has its own shape in his head, its own texture, its own weight. He knows it from himself. Can differentiate. So he goes back to it whenever he needs to and checks on it. Monitors it. Makes sure it's still isn't him. It reminds him of having a sore tooth, or the way he felt once when he was in love and didn't want to be. how his tongue always found the tooth, or how he'd always find that ache, that absence in the shape of the beloved. But the syndrome wasn't like that. It was separate from him and had nothing to do with anyone or anything he, Lainey, was even interested in. When he'd felt it starting, he'd taken it for granted that it would be about her, about Ray Toy, because there he was, close to her, or as close as you could get to anyone who didn't physically exist. They'd talked almost every day, Lainey and the Aidoru. And at first, he considered now, maybe it had been about her. But then it was as though he'd been following something back through the data flows, doing it without really thinking about it, the way your hand will find a thread on a garment and start pulling at it, unraveling it. And what had unraveled was the way he'd thought the world worked. And behind that, he'd found Harwood, who was famous, but famous in that way of being famous for being famous. Harwood, who they said had elected the president. Harwood, the PR genius, who'd inherited Harwood Levine, the most powerful PR firm in the world, and had taken it somewhere seriously else, into a whole other realm of influence, but who'd managed somehow never to become prey to the mechanism of celebrity itself, which grinds, Lainey so well knew, exceedingly fine. Harwood, who maybe, just maybe, ran it all, but somehow managed never to get his toe caught in it. Who managed somehow to be famous without seeming to be important, famous without being central to anything. Really, he'd never even gotten much attention except when he'd split with Maria Paz, and even then it had been the Padanian star who'd made the top of every sequence, which Cody Harwood, smiling from a series of sidebars, embedded hypertext lozenges. The beauty and this gentle-looking, secretive, pointedly uncharismatic billionaire. "Hello," Lainey says, his fingers finding the handle of a mechanical flashlight from Nepal. A crude thing, its tiny generator driven by a mechanism like a pair of spring-loaded pliers. Pumping it to life, he raises it, the faintly fluctuating beam finding the cardboard ceiling, which is plastered, inch by inch, with dozens of stickers, small and rectangular, produced to order by a vending machine inside the station's west entrance. Each one, a different shot of the reclusive Harwood. He can't remember going to the machine, executing a simple image search for Harwood, and paying to have these printed out, but he supposes he must have, because he knows that this is where they are from. But neither can he remember peeling the adhesive backing from each one and sticking them up on the ceiling. But someone did. "I see you," Lainey says, and relaxes his hand, letting the dim beam brown and vanish.